What's up, everyone? I have Dr. Alex Oshmiansky, who is the CEO of the Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company. That's a mouthful, and it's also amazing because that means I'm one degree of separation from Mark Cuban just being in the room, Alex.
Oh, I think even closer.
Even closer.
Sure. I'm not sure how or why, but you are. You definitely are.
Alex, thanks for coming on the show. I mean, you are someone who worked with my wife, actually, doing teleradiology, and we met a while ago. And at the time we met, you told me a story that I thought would be really compelling to my audience, which is drugs cost a lot of money. And they cost a lot of money partially because we're doing them completely wrong. We have middlemen. There's all kinds of drama that actually jacks up the prices of drugs. And you had this crazy opportunity to work with Mark Cuban of Shark Tank fame. That's forget everything else. It's just the Shark Tank. And he and you have started this company to try to disrupt drug delivery prices, everything. I mean, just tell me about it, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the company actually started it like five and a half years ago as a nonprofit.
Ah.
Yeah, so the idea was actually, you know, if I'm being honest in direct response to, you remember Martin Shkreli, the pharma bro?
Oh, how can you forget?
He's a delightful fellow.
Yes,
amazing.
A joy.
Yeah. I don't know, I just got so like angry at that. I was like, you know what, I'm going to go take myself, some friends who are doctors, we're going to start a nonprofit, we're going to make low-cost versions of these same drugs, which are very expensive. So I went out kind of hat in hand for like, say about 3 years after that, trying to raise money to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
And did not succeed. Failed absolutely miserably. Eventually, I ran into like a group of venture capitalists here in California, actually very close to here, a group called Y Combinator. They're like a...
Oh, I know those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, like a startup accelerator type deal. And basically, you know, they periodically donate to nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I gave them my pitch and they were like, hey, we like what you're doing, but you will not be able to get enough capital to get this off the ground as a nonprofit.
Now, you weren't just trying to make generic drugs, right? You were talking about very high cost drugs.
Yeah. So there are all these drugs, which for a variety of reasons that, you know, I'm sure we'll get into.
Right.
Like cost pennies to make, sometimes even less, but can retail for hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars for a single pill.
Yeah.
And it's this whole sort of corrupt, ball of like bad practices that gets the price so expensive with so many people between the drug and the individual patient that all need to get their cut.
Yeah.
Before you can actually get your medicine.
So it's like 13,000 middlemen in between that are each taking a chunk.
Yeah. So I can get, so what we can get into, so we just released our first drug from the program, which is an antiparasitic drug called albendazole.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very cheap drug to make. In most of the world, you can get it for like a few cents a pill. Basically, in the U.S., if you go to the pharmacy and try to pay cash for it, the odds are they'll ask that you pay, you know, $250 for each tablet. Wow. Not for the whole prescription, just for each tablet.
Gosh.
And the question becomes like, why is there disparity in the price of the drug? Initially, sort of the way it happened is you do need FDA approval in the U.S. to market your generic drug, which makes a lot of sense. Like, you don't want to just, like, be swinging drugs everywhere. But what happened is one company realized, hey, we're the only ones, even though this is a generic, we're the only ones who applied to the FDA to get the drug to the market. We basically have a monopoly. Why don't we try to, like, see what the market will bear and just keep increasing the price of the drug over and over and over again?
The Shkreli effect.
So in this case, the initial company that made it was kind of the bad guy of the story.
Mm.
But what happened was when the drug got to like $250 a tablet, the market took over. Basically, other drug companies were like, hey, we can also make $250 a tablet. So pretty quickly, like five or six different companies entered the market for this drug, but it stayed the same price.
Mm. And why is that?
Huh. I'm delighted to tell you. So actually, if you talk to the drug companies themselves, which we did, the price they're actually selling it for is far, far less. So I'm under a non-disclosure agreement with our source, but you know, essentially, I think it's safe to say we can buy it for about $10 a tablet.
Albendazole. This drug that's selling for like $250.
Exactly. Tab, right? Exactly.
But by the way, before we even go on, what do we use albendazole exactly for? I know it's an antiparasitic. In what's the main use case?
Oh, sure. And this is the most sort of like perverse part of it all. Is it treats conditions basically that are associated with indigent poverty, with extreme poverty.
Mm.
So it treats conditions like hookworm.
Uh-huh.
So it's a disease you get basically due to bad sanitation, which affects primarily populations of extreme poverty. Yeah, and you know we thought we eradicated it in the United States, but it's cropped back up in the American South.
Right, and causes anemia and other issues. And Peter Hotez was on the show talking about these neglected diseases, tropical diseases. So albendazole is a treatment for that, and ironically, it's $250 a tab to treat a disease of poverty.
Yeah, so we were actually working with Dr. Hotez and Dr. Mejia, their laboratories, because they wanted to set up mass treatment for hookworm. But it costs $250 a tablet. That's what they're getting asked to pay to treat this condition. And, you know, no grant can afford that. So basically what we did is we just purchased it at a lower price and just gave it to them for free. You know, I say we donated $2.5 million worth of albendazole. You know, in actuality, it's probably closer to like $100,000, even less.
Right.
But like, yeah, if they were to like apply for a grant, that's what it would have cost them to get that albendazole, which is just crazy.
And again, it's all because of these layers of obfuscation and profiteering and middlemen and all of that.
Yeah, so there's basically two primary layers of middlemen between you or more accurately, like the pharmacy and the pharmaceutical company. The first layer is the pharmaceutical wholesalers who have sort of a de facto monopoly. So three companies, McKesson, AmerisourceBerg, and Cardinal, control 80%+ of the wholesale market, which puts them in kind of a unique position. So I had to look this up. They're, a monopsony. So they're a buying monopoly. So the pharmaceutical companies essentially have to sell to them. So they can negotiate extremely good prices. You know, I can't know for sure, but I'm going to guess that they can get albendazole for an even better price than I can because, we can't match. You know, these are multi-billion-dollar corporations. There's no. If you look at the Fortune, 20 or even 10 list, I forget exactly where McKesson is, number 5 or 6. Like, it's all companies your average person on the street would recognize. You know, Apple, ExxonMobil, whatever. And then you see McKesson, and you're like, what is?
Right.
What is McKesson and why is it the
biggest? They make EHRs. They can't be making that much money from that. Or can they?
Yeah, right. Actually, now that you mention it. But yeah, talking to the pharmacists, if they want to buy albendazole from some of the big three wholesalers, what I was told is that it's currently going for $120 a tablet from the wholesalers. So that layer is capturing a delta.
Right, from the $10 up to... Or even less, because you're saying they can aggressively.
I'm sure they can probably get it. Well, I can't say for sure, but I'm sure, basically, that they can get it less for less than $10. But they're retailing it or wholesaling it for $120.
So this is interesting because your first instinct is to hate the pharma company primarily.
Yeah.
Well, why are the prices so high? But we forget, and they hold culpability as well.
Yep.
But it's this, so that even just the second layer of wholesaling is jacking up the price so much. Because they can. Is it just because they can?
It's just because they can, So essentially, the way it works is each independent pharmacy or each individual pharmacy will pick a single wholesaler to be their primary wholesaler. And they kind of trap them into the contract with this promise of a rebate. So they'll say, if you give us 80%, 90%, usually 90% of your total drug purchase, we'll rebate you, some percentage of the cost of all your purchases at the end of the year. So the pharmacy is led to believe that, they won't be profitable. They will not be able to exist without this rebate at the end of the year. So, you can buy 10% of your drugs from somebody else, but once you reach that threshold, you're endangering the viability of your company. But there are secondary wholesalers that if you go to, will actually just give you a lower cash price. And at the end, it works out in your benefit. But it's such a risk for the pharmacy to do that they generally don't. So part of our mission is education and just telling people and, healthcare practitioners, actually, you don't have to be beholden to these extreme contracts along the way.
Right. So how does your company then disrupt that process? What does it do differently?
Yeah. So basically, there's two things that we're doing. One is we are a proper pharmaceutical manufacturer. So as we speak, my construction guys are on site in Dallas. We're building a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant.
Oh, so you make the stuff.
So we actually make the stuff. Mm-hmm. So not albendazole specifically, but basically there are all these products which are in shortage, which are for rare disease, orphan drugs, which you're going to be very hard pressed to find people willing to get into the market and provide a reasonable price. Because, yeah, it's just, you know, if you need a drug for 60,000 doses for the entire country for the year, and it costs, you know, $1 million, $2 million to get your ANDA, your abbreviated new drug approval, through the FDA, you know, you're not going to sell that 60,000 doses for $1 a dose after.
Right.
But we are.
So how would you make money then?
So we will aggregate the costs over all the products we produce. So some of the high-cost products will subsidize the other ones and whatnot.
I see.
Yeah. And there's various regulatory strategies we'll try to play through.
Right.
But essentially, drugs which are in shortage as well. So I'm sure everybody who works in a hospital, you know, they're constantly trying to get, you know, bumetidine or, you know, even calcium carbonate, very simple drugs, which are just in constant shortage. So that facility is more targeted there. But our second line of business is basically what I'm calling our supply chain business, which is basically disintermediating all these sort of bad actors that are intermediaries in the pharmaceutical supply chain. And we haven't even touched on one of your favorite entities, which are the pharmaceutical benefit managers.
The PBMs, the notorious PBM, right.
The notorious PBMs.
Right.
As much as I love to harp on the wholesalers, at least they do serve a function. Like they do legitimately, you know, they do the whole. It would be incredibly inconvenient for a pharmacy to try to source each individual drug from a pharmaceutical manufacturer.
Right.
There's clear economies of scales that the wholesalers bring. So.
Right, because a pharmacy can just go to McKesson and say, "Okay, I want all these drugs." Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is, you know, in my humble opinion, they probably charge too much. That delta from like. You know, $10 a drug to $120 for their services, but there is a service. The second layer of basically middlemen in the system, which are, it's phenomenal to me how big these companies are, and I was no one's even heard of their industry. It's not like they haven't heard of the companies; they haven't heard of this industry. They don't know it exists, and it's the pharmaceutical benefit managers. So. Basically, this made sense back in like the 1980s before computers. Basically, what they do is they process insurance claims for pharmaceuticals for insurance companies. So your insurance company actually outsources like the management of each individual claim.
Right.
To one of the three big, generally PBMs. One of the three PBMs, you know, Express Scripts, Optum, or Caremark are the big three PBMs. And much like... the wholesalers, they have a de facto oligopoly or pseudo-monopoly in their industry, sort of regionally distributed. But what they discovered soon after, hey, there's only three of us. We're doing it for all the insurance companies in America. Like, what if we asked for money to be put on insurance formularies? So they started taking this function, not just processing the claims, you know, like 10 cents a claim or whatever to, you know, do all the paperwork associated with it.
The overhead stuff.
Yeah, they started proposing, hey, we can actually negotiate on behalf of the insurance companies for lower costs, which is also what the wholesalers are meant to be doing, but, you know, whatever. But they're like, yeah, we can negotiate for lower costs. And because we're, again, a monopsony, you know, we're buying monopoly. I just love that that's a random word that exists.
It's a good one.
It's a good word.
Right? It makes me want to put a monocle on and go, hey, everyone, did you hear about a monopsony? So they're threatening a monopsony. So these PBMs then, they had this generally good idea, which is, well, we can negotiate on behalf of the insurance company since we're processing their claims.
Yep.
Go to the wholesaler. Do they go to the wholesalers or the pharma companies directly?
Generally, they go to the pharma companies.
Pharma directly. And what do they do?
They basically say, hey, we would like a rebate back on the price of the drug. And hey, even better, you know, so that the insurance companies we work with know we're on the up and up, we won't even request a fee for doing that. We'll just take a percentage of the rebate. So suddenly, but let's say you're the PBM and you want to maximize how much money you're taking in. Suddenly the important number becomes the percentage of that rebate.
Yeah.
So how do you make the rebate as big as possible?
Make the price as high as possible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these rebates become basically de facto bribes to be placed on insurance formularies. Like, you know, pay us $40 a tablet or your product isn't going to be covered by insurance, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they say, I want a $40 rebate per tablet, or it's not going to be covered by insurance. In order to make any profit, then, I mean, the price of the drug has to go up.
Yeah, exactly. And the pharmaceutical companies are like, well, we can't not be covered by insurance.
So let's do this.
Let's do this. Yeah.
People don't know this.
And it's shocking that they don't. I don't think I'm too like tinfoil hatty conspiratorial in saying that's kind of intentional. Because if they did, like, again, CVS Caremark, one of the top five biggest companies in America on the Fortune 500 list, that's crazy. They process insurance claims.
Caremark is the PBM?
Is the PBM part of it. So I should say, you know, obviously CVS is a big company all its own.
Yeah.
But this is one of the ways they kind of, you know, mess with independent pharmacies as well. These entities are all vertically integrated at this point.
Right, because the pharmacy and the PBM are the same. Just like Optum is integrated with United, the insurance company is integrated with the PBM.
And they're in turn, oftentimes not technically like merged with each other, but partnered with. So like Cardinal is partnered with CVS Caremark.
Right.
So you have this whole vertically integrated kind of monstrosity that's like, you know, the money just stays with us no matter which part of it, you know, goes.
And what I love about this that people don't realize is they go, well, at least American healthcare is free market. At least it's capitalism. This is monopsony monopoly.
Yeah.
This is an oligopoly of several companies just enriching themselves, vertically integrating, pushing out independent pharmacies, pushing out independent doctors. The whole thing is anti-competitive.
Oh, absolutely. It's startling that the FTC allowed it to come to pass.
Like, well, I mean, why do you think that is? Because the same people that regulate through FTC are former members of these companies that in a revolving door go back
And I talked to independent pharmacists, you know, they have to pay these so-called DIR fees.
That's right.
Yeah.
Clawbacks.
Yeah. So basically they're getting paid less for the drugs from the PBMs because the PBMs are responsible for reimbursing them. And then they're charged a fee just to work with the PBMs.
Right.
The reimbursements keep going down. Like when you give a copayment to a pharmacist, the PBM can actually, one, not reimburse anything for the drug, and two, actually claw back part of that copayment. Mm. Plus, then they charge the independent pharmacist for even the privilege of working with
them. That's right. And the independent pharmacists are going out of business. And remember, these are the pharmacists who are, sorry, I'm just gonna move.
Oh, no, it's all good.
There we go. It's just because, as you get into it, dog, you're like, let me tell you the secrets of PBMs. Yeah. And you know what? We need to hear those secrets. So the independent pharmacists are the ones who, they know you. They're the ones who form relationships with you. My father used to work with independent pharmacists as a doctor, and they knew each other, man. Yeah. He could read their hand, like that guy could read my dad's handwriting. No one can read my dad's handwriting. And they're being squashed by this practice, right?
Yeah, because it's, you know, so if you're CVS Caremark, not to harp on them specifically, but, you know, let's harp on them specifically.
Why not?
Yeah. You know, it's not if the independent pharmacy goes out of business, that's less competition for CVS.
Mm.
And if they underpay both CVS and the independent pharmacies, they can say, well, these are the reimbursements we give to everyone.
Mm.
But if CVS makes less money, Caremark makes more money. So it doesn't really matter.
It's a wash.
It's a wash for them at the end of the day versus the independent pharmacies are driven out of business or forced to be bought out by CVS. And yeah, like you're saying, the independent pharmacists are the ones that are out there dealing with the most complicated patients.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones actually going into their community, actually acting as healthcare providers oftentimes, and, you know, helping those patients. They're just basically being driven out of the market by J.D. Rockefeller, you know, esque monopoly systems.
Right, yeah. Right. Again, we're back to the robber barons with the monocles. We're a monopsony, see? Well, so let me ask you a question. So the PBMs are clearly, they've evolved into being very bad news.
Yeah.
Maybe they started with good intention and they were serving a function, like you said, 10 cents per claim or whatever to process this because, you know, the insurance companies don't want to do it, and they're serving a role. But now it's evolved into this hegemony of weirdness. I don't even know if that's the correct word, but I like the word hegemony.
It sounds smart.
It just feels smart or conspiratorial. Like, did you hear about the hegemony?
Yeah, it's like the Illuminati.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Bro.
Respect.
Respect. So what you started up, and we can talk more about that in detail, how is that designed to disrupt this process, or does it?
Yeah, so I'm going to be a little bit coy and obnoxiously secretive because we have sort of plans in the works.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, broadly, we're looking for people who are still good actors in this space. So there are kind of like PBMs, like this feels weird to say, but like family-owned small PBMs that still operate on the old model, like 10 cents a transaction, price transparency type of model. And, you know, we're acting kind of de facto as a wholesaler on the sort of second part of our business. We're hoping, you know, kind of like shining lights to make the cockroaches go away, just transparency that people know actually what these drugs actually cost to make. So like for our pharmaceutical factory, we're going to reveal our books publicly. Everyone will know what our salary costs are, what our raw ingredient costs are, what it costs to build the facility, and how much we're adding to the price of the drug to account for the facility costs. Everything will be transparent. Yeah. So you'll know for sure, like, okay, it cost them like $5 to make this medicine, and they're charging, you know, a 15% margin. So, you know, they're charging 75%. That way we're profitable, we're sustainable, but at the same time, we're not extortionate. People know that we're basically doing the right thing by them.
So heaven forbid you're talking about price transparency in medicine, which doesn't exist. Like you said, the obfuscations, the layers of confusion are intentional, because if the public really found out what was going on, they would be like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. And then they would demand legislation, which would be very bad for these companies. And of course, the legislation would fail because the politicians are all paid by these companies through lobbyists. Sure. And that's how American capitalism actually works. If it was actually free market and we clawed away all the garbage and made it transparent competition and open and saying, hey, this is the profit we're making. Like you said, these are our costs. Our costs would drop. Our quality would improve through competition, and patients would get the drugs they need at the cost that's affordable, but it doesn't. So let me throw an example at you. So, and then I'm going to get at why the hell Mark Cuban is involved in this, because this is fascinating to me. I'm like, what did you go on Shark Tank? And like, well, this is the thing, drugs are expensive. And he was like, okay, I'm investing, but we'll talk about that. But like, let's say insulin. Insulin's been in the news, right? People who need this drug to survive are having to spend more and more and more money. EpiPens, same thing.
Yep.
How would your company interfere with this price escalation? Would you start making the drug yourself and then clearly and transparently pricing it? Would the pharmaceutical companies, do they license the process to you? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so we're kind of exploring our options on those two products specifically.
You're looking at those especially.
Again, I'll be a little bit coy, but we're looking at a lot of different products and trying to figure out the ones we can attack that will have the most impact for the most people. But basically all of the above. So sort of tackling it drug by drug. It's amazing when I talk to the pharmaceutical companies, like they, as you might imagine, aren't as furious about the like middleman system as anyone. Kind of my general salesman pitch to them is, or business development pitch to be hoity-toity about it, is like, in any opaque market in classic capitalism, like if it's an opaque market, the winners are neither the buyers nor the sellers. So it's not, so like dark pools of equity that Goldman Sachs set up. The buyers and sellers of those stocks are not the winners. Goldman Sachs
is
the winner. The middleman's the winner.
Yeah.
And they're like, yep, that's right. That totally makes sense. Like,
so the pharmacies agree.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical companies, and bizarrely enough, are totally on board with it generally when I talk to them, because they're like, yeah, I spent, you know, even the brand name ones, because they're like, hey, I spent 20 years of research and development, hundreds of millions of development costs. Why is half the profit going to the PBMs? This makes no sense.
Right.
Yeah, these sort of rent-seeking actors in between.
And who's paying? We are.
And yeah, exactly.
The patients are paying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through high premiums.
Yeah,
through copays, through out-of-pocket expense.
Or if you're about 50% of people who are on private insurance plans are under plans that are sort of self-insured by their employer.
Right.
So the employer is directly paying for those costs.
That's right. 50%. And people don't realize that in those companies where they're paying all their healthcare costs directly, where is that money coming from? Your wages.
Yep.
Our competitive advantage in the world relative to other countries where it's, you know, tax subsidized or whatever.
If you are making furniture, why are you paying an extra $500 a year per employee for PBM fees?
Right.
Like it's insanity.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's nuts. So, but then is there any advantage to, you said you're working with like kind of ma and pa smaller PBMs, if such a thing does exist. what's the advantage of having a PBM at all? Is it purely administrative?
Yeah. You can see, you know, again, I'm harping hard on the PBMs, but, you know, if you are like an employer, you probably don't want to hire a person full time to like learn to, right, and then, you know, process all the paperwork for each individual insurance claims by your employee.
Right.
Yeah. So you're like, okay, 10 cents a, you know, each time some paperwork needs to be filed.
Right.
Fair enough.
Right.
So, they do serve a function for those self-insured entities.
Right.
For insurance companies, it is bizarre to me. I don't really understand, you know, even living this day in, day out, like 24 hours a day for years. I don't really understand why they outsource that function. Because you're like, you're an insurance company.
That's all you do is process
paperwork.
Yeah.
So that I don't really understand.
Yeah. You know, it might have been. Yeah. I don't know. We're speculating. But you know what is what is interesting about this is when something like your thing comes up, one of the big objections people will raise is, well, but I bet you don't play nice with insurance, so you're probably asking for cash pay. Is that right, or do you work with insurance?
No, we'd love to work with insurance. Like, why wouldn't we?
Right.
You know, I don't want our albendazole to cost, you know, at the end of the day, we have a manufacturer suggested retail price. Only drug company I know of that does that, of $20 a tablet. I don't want people paying $20 a tablet. I want them paying a dollar or whatever their copay is. I want it to be free.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
So, obviously, we want to play nice with the insurance companies for that purpose. It's just when we do, we insist on transparency in the pricing.
Right.
That's sort of our line in the sand.
Right.
We want to make sure, yeah.
Well, these entities are going to resist you, which is now why I'm starting to feel the Mark Cuban thing actually is an advantage, because, you know, the Mark Cuban cost plus drug company, it's a little kitschy of a name, right? But in a way, putting Mark Cuban's name in that says, hey, no, we're actually dead serious, because we have the resources and the innovative drive to actually do this, and we're not messing around. How did you get hooked up with Mark?
Oh, so actually I just cold emailed him.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Like the kind of emails I get?
Yeah.
Zubin. And it looks like it's formed in there.
Yep, yep.
You know, we believe we can provide your website with many, many services, and then poor English. And, So you did that.
Yeah. So I did that for me. Yeah. Yeah. Poor English. Whole nine yards.
Exactly. Are you Russian by descent?
My family's Russian. I was born in Denver, but.
Got it. That's like me. My family's from India, but I was born in New Jersey.
Yeah.
But actually, technically, we're Persian because they're Middle Eastern by descent. But what does that have to do with this? Nothing. Back to this. You send a poorly Englished cold email to Mark Cuban.
Yeah. And believe it or not, he reads his cold emails. Like, and his public email is out there, mcuban@gmail.com. Like, if you email him, he personally will read it.
That's
which was nice. Startling to me. He doesn't have like minions that I figured would be doing it. But
you know what's interesting is the very connected billionaires like that, like my late friend Tony Hsieh, read all his emails. It was tony@zappos.com, and he read every single one. I mean, he had minions to help once he triaged them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So Mark read this email.
Yeah, he read this email, basically respond back, like, tell me more. And, you know, I was kind of startled. He knew all of this. Like, he had been looking for ways to kind of get past this for years, because he had done his research and in intimate detail knew about the PBMs, knew about the wholesalers.
Is that because he's running companies that are affected by this? Or?
You know, I never asked him how he knew. I just figured he was interested in it and like did his research.
Right.
But yeah, maybe part of it was, the Mavs, you know, they have to pay these same costs that everybody else does.
Right.
Not sure how exactly he knew, but he is very well versed in sort of the nitty gritty details of this stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, everyone you see is sort of a celebrity on TV, you assume they're just kind of a talking head, but no, Mark's the real deal. Like, he knows like what the PBM overhead stuff is in like granular details. So
does he get as outraged as we get about it?
If not more so, because, you know, I try, you know, we're fancy schmancy doctors. We talk professionally and stuff. Like, he's not obligated to do that. He'll scream and yell and just be like, this is so messed up.
He has FU money.
He has FU money.
This is what I'm going to say. Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, no, he's also a shockingly normal person. You know, I imagine probably your interactions with Tony, bless his soul.
Yeah.
Such a kind individual.
Truly authentic, genuine person. Yeah.
Yeah.
And people can lose their way, but at the same time be just genuinely human.
Shockingly normal guy.
Like, that's awesome.
You know, you talk to a lot of people in sort of investment and VC world, they have the sort of professional managerial class, you know, sort of like airs about them because, you know, that's their job is to present themselves professionally.
Right.
Mark's just a normal dude. Like if you're talking to him, he just talks. You know, he, like you said, he has FU money, so he just talks like a normal human being.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it is actually startlingly refreshing.
It's the top of Maslow's hierarchy, where you're just like, oh, I can self-actualize now because I'm not going to be on the street. Yeah.
But no, he's very involved in the like day-to-day details of the company as well. Like he send, you know, communicates with me like, I don't know, at least 4 or 5 times a week. And like, he's like, what if we do this? What if we do that differently?
That's
great. So he's very passionate about these issues.
Yeah, and he probably sees the world a little bit differently than us doctors do, which is really good because we get in our own heads. And, you know, it's really amazing because you're a radiologist.
Yeah.
And yet you got involved in drug manufacturing and sales.
Yeah, just think of me as kind of George Costanza. Like, I was just angry about this. And I was just like, I'm going to do this all out of spite.
And so you basically built your own pirate shirt factory, basically. Costanza style. Amazing. I feel like Kramer's going to walk in at any moment now. Yeah. So it was just pure outrage.
Yeah, just, I know you talk about like, what is the term? Like moral outrage or moral fatigue on your
moral
show?
Moral injury.
Moral injury, yeah. That's it. Yeah, no, I was just mad and just sort of like went off on this tangent for, you know, the better part of the last decade at this point.
And you're still doing radiology almost full time.
I've had to peel it back a lot. Yeah. So now I still do like a shift every Saturday night.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. But like the week, there's just so much going on.
Oh yeah. Even before you got on the show, I mean, you're putting out fires and doing all kinds of stuff and being an entrepreneur. What did you have entrepreneurial experience before you started this thing?
Oh, sure. So I did actually. That was kind of the little niche I found for myself within the academy because everyone finds sort of entrepreneurship to be very mysterious, even though it's very, as you know, as a fellow entrepreneur, like very banal at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's like, oh gosh, the city's on me to like mow the lawn.
My business license expired because I forgot to fill out the paperwork.
Yeah. Absolutely right there with you. During grad school, I actually started a company that made door handles that dispense waterless hand sanitizer when you use them. Yeah, totally.
That's actually brilliant.
Thank you.
So as you turn the door handle, it just squirts some...
Yeah, exactly. It was because I kept forgetting to wash my hands when I went between patient rooms.
Yep.
And
docs are the worst about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to kill someone.
Yeah.
I don't want to kill anybody by doing this. So.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah. So like, that company's been going strong for 15 years. As you might imagine, like sales, I think went up by like a factor of 10 because of the pandemic.
So you're forget about monopsony. You're a pandemic profiteer.
Yeah. I'm fundamentally an evil person.
I figured as much. It's the beard. Exactly. We need to get you a little cat. Well, Mr. Cuban, I've taken your money and squandered it on pills.
so many pills.
So many pills. You had that experience.
Yeah, so I had that experience. I mean, I left the company like pretty soon after it started. So I ran it as the CEO for about a year or two and then moved to being like a part-time CFO and then left. You know, was still on the board for a while, left completely a couple of years ago just because it's sort of outgrown me.
Right.
I had that experience of like starting a company, you know, all these like arcane things like what's a convertible note? All these sort of like
board of directors.
Yeah, setting these up like, oh man, lawyers are really like taking advantage of me. I have to manage the lawyers.
That's one thing that I, as a entrepreneur, someone who wanted to be an entrepreneur and ended up doing it, I was shocked at how much lawyers. Actually, if you're talking about PBMs, we might as well talk about lawyers real quick because they take so much revenue to do so little, really, but it's necessary in the current structure.
Yeah. So what I quickly learned is lawyers make work for themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So basically at the
especially
time,
when two lawyers talk to each other.
Exactly.
Like, oh, my company's talking to their company's lawyer. They're going to make work for themselves. Suddenly, Blue Cross actually gave us a cease and desist for our logo for Turntable Health because they said it looked blue and it was in healthcare.
Awesome.
And I had a copyright lawyer who was like, okay, well, I'll call their lawyer. And the next thing I knew, it's like $20,000 of legal fees. And all they said was, change the color one shade lighter of blue. And I'm like, this is a joke. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. This is bringing back like PTSD flashbacks. Right? You have similar things. Eventually what I learned was one, you got to say no to the lawyer. So they'll recommend things and you just got to cut them off and just be like, no.
No.
And the second thing we moved to, this was deeply ironic to me. You know, we were frustrated with like basically overbilling from our lawyers at the time. And we moved to basically the most expensive law firm we could find, which was this group. Actually, I really like them, Wilson Sonsini. They do a lot of startup stuff here in Silicon Valley. Our costs actually went way down.
Because they're more directed and...
They're more directed. Yeah. And I just think, you know, there's no way to prove this. This is perhaps me being, oh, I don't want to get sued by anyone for saying this. But basically like inflating your billable hours because they pay you per hour worked.
Right.
And I just think our new lawyers are just honest with us about like, you know, what the actual time is they spend.
Right.
And, you know, maybe they don't have like junior associates who need to learn the law and you pay them to learn the law.
That's right. Yeah.
They just have like senior people like, oh, yeah, I just need to like write one line. Takes 15 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And what's it, so, because, you know, these little details are interesting. People don't, this is why a lot of physicians and nurses don't succeed instantly in business. It's a lot of work learning this stuff. And, you know, what other things have you learned? Because do you have a board of directors or is it all Mark? Like, how is it working now? Because you started at did you approach Y Combinator? I cut off your story early on.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So approached Y Combinator just, again, cold emailed. You know, I don't really have my...
Well, so this is the lesson, guys. Just start cold emailing everybody and all your dreams will come true.
Actually, totally. You can't say anything else. Yeah. But yeah, no, they have a webpage where you can just apply to be funded by them. And I did. And they called me in and they basically said, you know, if you convert from a nonprofit to a public benefit corporation, we will just invest in you like we would in any other company. So public benefit corporation is a for-profit company, but with like a public mission in its charter.
I see.
Yeah.
So you're not a non, because they're not investing in nonprofits.
So they do.
They do? They, okay.
I guess it would be donating to nonprofits.
Yeah. Exactly. That's
but they have like a nonprofit or two, I think, in each of their batches.
I see.
You know, they fund companies once or twice a year.
I see. So Y Combinator is where you kind of incubated?
Yep.
Yeah.
It worked really well. Wound up raising, you know, a little over $1 million coming out of their program from other sort of socially minded investors.
Other outraged people who
wanted
to see
other mad people who were on board. Emailed Mark, you know, a couple months after that. And yeah, just taken off dramatically since then. So in terms of, you know, the structure, you know, this is strange to say because, you know, my old company had a board of directors and how to set that up. To your point, like this is stuff that you really can't find anywhere. Mm-hmm. You can't find this information short of like listening to YouTube videos of people talking like this. Seriously.
It's true. Yeah.
The only way to learn it is kind of by doing it and messing it up the first time. And then the next time you can not mess it up basically.
Yeah.
The way it's worked out since is basically I am my own board of directors. There's a board of directors of one and I'm that person. Of course, it would be madness for me to do anything that, you know, Mark was like dead set against.
Right.
But I find myself usually in agreement with him on like 98-99% of stuff, if not that, because I don't know. It's nice when it's almost like dating. You like click with someone and you're like, oh, we're on the same page.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what it was like with Tony and Turntable. We just kind of understood each other. And the nice thing about Tony is he wasn't there to, you know, if he didn't care if it worked or not, he wanted it to make a difference somehow.
Yep.
And it did. And the thing is, you were never worried like, oh my gosh, you know, what if the thing, you still were though, right? You're still worried all the time. Every day I would wake up like, what if this fails? And, you know, when we finally did have to close it, it was actually more of a relief than like this horrible thing. Cause it was like, oh, we were fighting so hard in this losing battle, sitting with like United Health at the table and them talking about giving us like 11 per patient per month for primary care or something ridiculous.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's the same because they're a monopsony.
Yeah.
I'm learning your words now.
I love that word. I mean, it makes me feel so smart.
It does. And, And you knew that until we disrupt even more deeply and sow the seeds for real change, and some of it is outrage. Some of it is you have to make people feel how unjust the situation is, right? And how big is your company now? Like, how many people are you?
Actually, it's still very small, but we have essentially a small army of contractors.
Right.
And part of that is a lot of the tasks we're doing now, building the factory will only have to be done once.
Right.
It'd be, rather than hiring the construction guys full time, which would be a little silly, we hire, contractors to contract all that out or a lot of the regulatory stuff. But I think we'll probably be between 60 and 80 people this time next year, full time employed.
Got it.
And that'll probably, the majority of that will actually be just the line staff at the factory, the people who are hands on making the medicine.
Where can people find more information about what you're doing?
Sure. So our webpage is www.costplusdrugs.com.
That's a good URL.
Right?
You can do the www in just to keep it old school, man. That's what my dad, whenever my dad, he talks about websites, he's like, okay, go to www. It just took you 5 minutes to get through the www. Now I got to listen to the spelling of the rest of this thing.
And well, I just confident. Want people to know it's on the World Wide Web.
That's
important. You can surf that whenever you want.
I understand. Yeah. I have my AOL dial-up, 2200 baud. that's one page of text every 25 seconds. I just learned that reading a preprint of Federico Fajin's book. He's writing about he's one of the fathers of microprocessors. And he was talking about the early dial-up speeds. And I was like, wow, I remember getting on those bulletin boards. You would get on these bulletin boards where you would interact with other people. This was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it was 2200 baud modem, and it would be you would hear individual bits.
We're actually working with, my teleradiology firm, the same one your wife used to work for.
Right.
Feels a lot like late 90s, chat. And I was really bad at it as a teenager. So I'm still bad at it now as a teleradiologist, talking to everyone else in the practice.
You don't use enough emojis.
Yeah.
What's the emoji for Gone complex?
I think it's a dancing turkey. Pretty sure it's a dancing turkey.
Radiology emojis. Yeah, it's interesting because the way you guys did teleradiology is, there was this open chat window and you guys are sharing, asking each other questions, and it's actually very collegial, great. Even at a distance. Yeah,
yeah, it's I've worked with the same folks for 6-7 years now,
right.
And I feel like I know them, though I've never actually met them in person.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's pandemic, pre-pandemic, you guys were doing this.
We were in isolation before it was cool.
That's true. You guys were edgy. So what's your vision for where this thing will go in terms of affecting the bigger picture of everything?
Oh, sure. My grandiose vision is kind of just, setting up a parallel supply chain and parallel manufacturing base that just goes around all these sort of pathologic entities and just be like, hey, get your drugs at an honest, transparent price if you go this route through the following actors.
So it's true disruption. You're saying, okay, we start out small on the fringes, then we create a parallel thing that's better, cheaper, more effective, and then the old players are out of business.
Yeah, so the traditional Clay Christensen,
real innovators.
Disruption, yep.
So here's a question of the beautiful thing about working with Cuban then is that he's probably not keen to just sell you off to some PBM. In other words, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, a lot of the companies, clearly this is not a, brilliant profit. Innovative idea, make drugs cheap is an old concept, it's not that hard to think of. But a lot of time what happens is, people who go into it with good intentions just get a huge buyout offer and just take that. And Mark's like, we don't need that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
that's another,
we can't be bought out, essentially.
The Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company, it's another advantage of that. And, you know, and it was the same thing working with Tony. We weren't there to sell our thing to some big, buyer and get rich. That wasn't the goal. It was to make a real difference. This is great. And what I think is where your thing fits in is in this bigger model of health 3.0. So price transparency, reasonable profit, so you do well by doing good for people, competition, and getting rid of anything that doesn't need to be there.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's enough in between the drug companies and the purchaser, the patient, that doesn't need to be there. Now, some people would say even insurance doesn't need to be there and we ought to have a single payer and so on. How would a single payer plan affect your business model?
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, my kind of my personal politics aside, kind of the way I went into this is like, I'm like a radiologist from like central Montana. No one cares what I think from a policy perspective. I have zero ability to influence or change politics. So I am going to play the ball as it lies and work within the structures as they currently exist. Just because I have, you know, if like Bernie Sanders with tens of millions of followers and this like brilliant vision, like can't change the system. Like Dr. Osh Miansky with the unpronounceable name is not going to be able to change the system. So, you know, until such a point comes when the system changes, you know, we're just going to work within what is right. set up for us, what the barriers are. We're just going to, you know, power through them as best we can.
So adapt to what is. Yeah, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Man, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see how this thing turns out, because any innovation, any disruption to the, I'm going to use the wrong word, hegemony, because I like it, because it sounds good, to the existing oligopoly that is healthcare, I think we ought to be encouraging, we ought to be shining a light on, we ought to be, especially when there's a practicing physician involved, because that changes the dynamic quite a bit. So you have this really good combination of Mark Cuban and you, which is crazy.
It's surreal. Like, you know, our offices, well, at least before the pandemic, were in, you know, Dallas Mavericks headquarters.
That's awesome.
no joke.
See, you must get a lot of perks.
Well, I assume the basketball players are the guys who are 7 feet tall, who are like walking around. I'm like, yeah.
So you're like me with sports.
Yeah, I consider myself a total baller.
You know, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, B-A-W-L-E-R.
That's oh, indeed, the, yes, indeed. I think I'm not yet at the cool kids table, but maybe one day, maybe one day.
Well, listen, George Costanza, you're at the cool kids table right now, all right?
Because darn Skippy.
Look at me, just look at me. How cool, darn Skippy. Dude, thanks a million for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And, you know, we'll get you back to see and update as things grow, because I'm excited to see it evolve. And you guys can go to costplusdrugs.com. Mm-hmm. Sorry, www.costplusdrugs.com and check it out. And, you know, share this episode. If you want to become a supporter of the show, I won't complain, because we go deeper on things. And if you like what we do, you can also give us a little tip in the tip jar. This is the thing, I put like my little hat out like a like a street busker now. It's just paypal.me/zdogmd. We take all that money. Tell them about the studio, dude. Tell them about what you see here.
Oh, this is sweet. Like, there's like really professional equipment in here, right? Yeah.
Who pays for it? Y'all do. No big pharma. Right? You know what? There was a time, Alex, when I would have been reluctant to have you on. By the way, you're not sponsoring this episode. No one's paying me to have you on the show. I would have been nervous to have you on, because I would be afraid that I might piss off CVS or Walgreens or Optum, because maybe they might want to sponsor our show. And we were always hustling to try to pay the bills, pay the team. Now I don't care about any of that.
That's
because
so awesome.
Yeah. We're fully funded by our supporters, and you know, some ad revenue here and there and that kind of thing. And if the ads dry up, then our supporters fill the void. So that's the wonderful thing about being in our audience's pocket instead of in big whatever's pocket. So guys, we'd love to be in your pocket. Came out wrong. I'll edit that out later, or I won't. All right, guys, I love you. Until next time, we out. Peace. Become a subscriber. Click the subscribe button, then right to the right of his little bell. Hit that bell. Booyah! You get notifications. Never miss any of our stuff. I love you guys. We out.